You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, new reports show that students at technical colleges in Wisconsin are facing higher student loan debts. We'll talk to an educational policy expert about why that is.
First, we're taking a look at recent news from Shawano County, where a plan to expand a once-limited gambling hall is creating some controversy. The Stockbridge, Muncie, and Menominee tribes have objected to the planned Ho-Chunk Wittenberg expansion.
The tribes that have opposed the move have asked the state's Department of Administration to block the expansion, but the secretary of the department said last month that the plan didn't break current rules. Matt DeFore joins us now. He's a state capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. He's covering this story. Matt, welcome back to the show.
Rob, always a pleasure.
Well, these casino stories always get a little complicated because there's different levels of government, different tribal governments, the state government, and more. Spell out the basics. What would happen in this expansion?
So Ho-Chunk is hoping to do a $33 million expansion, where right now they have about 500 slot machines at this facility just east of Wausau. And they want to add, I think, about 200 or so more, 250 more slot machines. They want to add table games, a high-limit area, as well as a hotel and a restaurant to a facility that historically has been a smaller, like a truck stop kind of gambling facility, known as an ancillary facility.
Right, and this was news to me. There's different categories of casinos. There's the regular full-on ones that we think of. We see the ads all the time. And then there are these ancillary ones. Talk about those a little more.
Sure. So the ancillary facilities are identified in the compact with the state. If you remember, the state has compacts with the Indian tribes that limit how many gambling facilities they can have. In the Ho-Chunk's case, they're allowed to have four main casinos and then five of these ancillary casino facilities. And, you know, maybe we aren't as familiar with them down here in the southern part of the state, because most of them are in the northern parts of the state, but you'll find them at truck stops and sort of gas stations usually. And they'll have anywhere from, you know, dozens to, you know, several hundred slot machines, but they're usually not more expansive gaming facilities with, you know, again, like a resort kind of situation with a hotel or, you know, table games, something you'd think of more as like a full-scale casino.
So the Ho-Chunk want to expand this ancillary gambling facility. Menominee and Stockbridge Muncie tribes are saying no, they shouldn't be allowed to do this. What do they see as the problem? What's the concern there?
Yeah, they're framing this as a fairness issue. And in the case of the Stockbridge Muncie, they have a full-blown casino about, you know, 15 or 20 minutes east of the Ho-Chunk Wittenberg facility. So there's an economic competitiveness issue. That's their only casino in the state. And so they're worried that, they've been competing with this sort of smaller slot machine facility for years. But if they're all of a sudden going to be a much larger casino and hotel, almost on a similar scale, maybe not quite as large as their facility, but maybe more of a destination for people in the Wausau area, that they're going to lose out economically.
Talking to Matt DeFore, a reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal, looking at controversy between tribes in Wisconsin over a proposed Ho-Chunk casino expansion plan at what is currently an ancillary facility, a smaller gambling establishment. And there's where, Matt, the conflict comes in. What is an ancillary facility? How big can it get? What other amenities can be attached to it? From the arguments you've seen, from what you've heard from the state, what does that phrase mean? Is there a limit on what they can do there?
There is some limitations on these ancillary facilities. Historically, there had been even more limitations. In the past, there were limitations on how much revenue could come from certain types of from gambling, and what kind of games it could be offered. But in 2003, when Governor Jim Doyle amended the compacts, there were changes made. And so, in the case of the Ho-Chunk compact, their ancillary facilities, they as long as the facility, the square footage doesn't exceed 50% for gambling purposes, they're still considered an ancillary facility. Now, the Stockbridge Muncie say that's absurd, because if you had a 10-acre site, for example, you have a 5-acre ancillary casino, and that's much larger, obviously, than any casino currently in the state. So their concern is that what this interpretation that the Department of Administration is honoring is essentially, rather than allowing the Ho-Chunk to have four casinos, that they would have effectively nine casinos available in the state. Now, not all of those are currently built. They've built four. They have three full casinos. They have the smaller casino in Dane County, and I believe they have two of their five ancillary or two or three of their ancillary facilities built. But there's just. This could be a longer-term issue if you turn into larger facilities.
So, Matt, when one tribe says, we can, we'll build this, other tribes say, no, you can't, who's the decider? Does that go to the governor, like the Menominee proposal in Kenosha? Does it end up in courts? Who decides this issue?
Well, as I looked into this, it turns out that this is a very different issue than the what we saw a couple of years ago with the Menominee tribe trying to build a casino in Kenosha. That was going to be built off reservation, and in those situations, the governor does have veto power over whether that land can be essentially put in trust for the use by an Indian tribe for a casino. That's not at issue here because the Ho-Chunk Nation, while they don't have a contiguous reservation, they have members who own tribal land all over the state. And so this particular facility in Wittenberg is on tribal land. And so the governors, you know, DOA, they've basically said there's nothing we can really do. And I know I talked to Senator Rob Coles, who's represents the area. He similarly said he doesn't think there's anything the state can do. So, you know, it may be that this will be taken up in court. And at that point, the court would have to look at how the compacts are written between the state and the tribe and just determine whether this fits the definition of an ancillary facility.
So where is this proposal now? Are they breaking ground on the expansion, or is this just in blueprint or idea form right now?
Right. No, they've actually broken ground. The groundbreaking was a month ago. So this is not sort of a, you know, I think we're used to seeing when people object to development projects, it's sort of when they're first proposed, at least here in Madison. But no, this is already underway. So the Stockbridge-Muncie has not yet said for sure that they're going to file a lawsuit. But, you know, if they aren't able to get anywhere with this, perhaps with the state, that they may have to follow that route. We'll see.
So if this principle that you can take this smaller ancillary facility and make it substantially bigger as is happening here, we could end up with a lot more gambling, a lot more slot machines in the state.
Well, that's one concern that's certainly being raised with this issue. Now, as far as we could tell, there are 12 ancillary facilities identified in compacts. At least 12. There's one, for example, that the St. Croix tribe has up in northwestern Wisconsin, and they've recently actually broken ground on an expansion of their facility where it's going to add about 100 slot machines, almost doubling what they have now, and they're going to add an RV park and an amphitheater. And a restaurant. And so, we may be seeing as tribes, obviously many of these tribes are looking for ways to expand their ability to bring in revenue. We may be seeing these ancillary facilities now expand as the market allows them to.
Matt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Matt DeFore, state capitol reporter covering state government for the Wisconsin State Journal, talking about expansion plans for smaller, more limited gambling halls in Shawano County.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, technical colleges are usually seen as an affordable option for higher education, but recent numbers from the U.S. Department of Education show that students at Wisconsin technical colleges have higher debt than ever before. More on that in just a couple minutes.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Antonio Saldana began working in the fields with his family as a migrant worker when he was 4 years old. He tells us about his childhood and becoming the first in his family to graduate high school and then college in Green Bay.
I started working as a migrant worker at the age of four. Everybody had to work, not just mom and dad, everybody. If you could walk and talk, you were expected to work. The family had been coming to Oconto since the 30s and 40s. We were just there from the middle of July until the first week, second week of September, and then the cucumber harvest would finish, and then you would go to the next state for harvesting another crop. You went to school there in each city that you were at. So you were never there more than 2, 3, 4 weeks. So you didn't make a whole lot of friends because the language barrier. Because although we were born, like I was born in Oconto, we were only around the migrant workers. So we could understand English and speak it, but it was very limited. I was doing better academically, and the teachers took an interest in what I had to say. So school was a lot of fun, but then a month before school was out, the students never understood why then I'd be gone, because then I would have to hop on the Greyhound, and you're scared. You're 14. So you get on the bus, and you're on that bus for about 2 days, and then you travel all the way to Torrington, Wyoming, where you're going to Hobetz. The sun was not our friend. He was our enemy. And I used to just look up at the sun and think, oh my gosh, I hate the sun. It is so hot, you know. But we love the rain. If it rained, you didn't have to work. But then there was nothing to do. There was 14 of us. Our shack was only between 24 and 25 feet long and about 14, 16 feet wide. You know the joke, it's so small, I have to go outside to change my mind. That's about the way it was. Well, I always knew I didn't know anything about education because my dad had zero education. My mom only had a fifth grade education. But somehow, like in my mind, I knew this isn't what I want to do and there's a way out. Out of all the Saldanhas that we've been here, I am a fourth generation. And I was the first one to graduate from high school. You know, as a school teacher, I just tried telling my students, I go, this subject that I teach, Spanish, might not seem important to you, but if you don't like the situation that you're in, education can do this for you. So that the kids want, a lot of the kids had the same dreams that I had, but there's a lot of the children that do that, that are trying to get out. But how can you have dreams when you can't even dream? When that sun's beating you, when there's not enough to eat, how can you have dreams? We are not an invisible people. If you went back to the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and early 70s, there was anywhere from 1,400 to 1,600 families at one time in Oconto and Lena, all those places. We were a part of that economical system, and there's nothing there to remember us.
Antonio Saldana is a Spanish teacher in Green Bay. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, attending a technical college is one way to access higher education at a lower cost, but new numbers from the U.S. Department of Education show that students of Wisconsin's technical colleges are facing rising costs.
A couple of examples, as reported in Gannett newspapers in Wisconsin. Students at Fox Valley Technical College saw their tuition triple over a four-year period, while Waukesha County Technical College grads had a debt increase of $6,000. At the same time, tuition and fees are generally on the rise.
Nick Hillman joins us now. He's an associate professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis here at UW-Madison. Nick, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for inviting me.
So you've been able to dig into these numbers a little bit. Can you give us a picture of the debt burden for a student attending a technical college here in Wisconsin?
I can give part of that picture.
Okay.
One of the challenges that we have in this area of financial aid policy is the domain that we're talking about, is that we actually have really poor data. And so it's hard to know precisely what's going on in terms of trends and who's struggling with debt. But on average, the technical college student in the state of Wisconsin, and there's about 160,000 students across the state attending technical colleges. So it's big. It's about as big as the UW system in terms of degree-seeking students. But the average loan, at least with the most recent data, is about $4,700, and that's for 1 year of school. And the average tuition is about $4,300. So if we just looked at those two numbers, we might think that the loan is covering tuition. But that's not all that loans are being used to cover.
What else are they covering?
Well, tuition accounts, depending on the school, and there are 16 campuses across the state of tech colleges, depending on the school, you know, you've got your tuition bill, but you've also got these other non-tuition expenses that are incorporated in your total cost of attendance, and loans can pay for those things as well, and they should pay for those other non-tuition items as well. So, you know, the cost of enrolling in college is not just tuition, but it's also paying your bills and being able to have your living expenses covered while you take time off of work, for example. If you have dependents, it might be caring for dependents. And how are you going to do that if you're back in school? And so the federal government designed the loan program to account for these non-tuition expenses. And so, yes, tuition is rising, but these other non-tuition expenses are rising at the same time that family incomes are flattening. And so there's just a lot of financial need out there that that students are turning to loans to utilize to cover those needs.
Why is there an incomplete data set on this? You know, why are there holes in the data?
You know, this is the question that that researchers have, and we want an easy answer too. But the federal government and politicians in particular in Washington, D.C. are reluctant to have these national student unit record data systems, and they're very proprietary with respect to the data. And so the U.S. Department of Education holds all of the loan records for everybody who has a student loan. And so students as loan holders can go in and find their individual records, or colleges can make requests to pull down that data. But this is not widely available public data that just anybody can use. It's got a lot of confidential information for good reason. It's protected, but at the same time, we sure do want to know more so we can help inform policymaking.
And in Wisconsin, student debt is third highest in the country. What are some factors contributing to that?
Right. So that comes from a really recent report that aggregates both public colleges and private colleges together, and it only looks at students who graduated with a bachelor's degree. And so it's a very narrow set of the student population. It includes federal and non-federal loans. It sort of is it's the everything all sort of lumped together here. And you're right, Wisconsin is one of the highest. Part of that is because the state has been over time, divesting in public higher education and pushing the costs onto students in terms of tuition. Even though there's been a tuition freeze within the UW system, we still have these non-tuition expenses that keep rising, and fees also keep rising. And so part of it is state divestment, but that doesn't explain it all. Part of it is also, like I said earlier, just families have greater financial needs, and grant programs like the federal Pell Grant, which is money that doesn't have to be repaid like a loan, and even state and campus financial aid programs aren't buying as much tuition as they used to for students.
And what do these figures tell us about the number of tech students who are defaulting on federal loans?
Now, here's the real interesting question. So a lot of times we correlate the rise in student loan debt and the big shocking numbers of $30,000 in student loan debt or even $100,000 in student loan debt. And there's this mental shortcut that happens where we think that high debts are causing students to default, when actually it's just the opposite. It's the students who have low debts who maybe just enrolled in one semester of tech college, and they might not even know they had a loan, which, you know, for financial aid folks, actually is not that surprising because it's such a confusing process. Sometimes students don't know the differences between grants and loans, even though they've gone through the formal counseling that the
advising session. Sure.
But they're struggling with relatively small loans because they don't have that credential that helps them earn higher earnings in the labor market. So you have debt and no degree.
And one administrator was critical of the default rating, saying anyone can enroll in tech colleges and students tend to be, quote, older, poorer, and less educated. How does that argument stand up?
I don't think it holds. It doesn't stand up very strongly because that assumes that student loan default is a pre-existing condition, that students are just more likely to default and the college has no responsibility over helping that student navigate this extremely complex system. And so I would reject that that argument and say that colleges have more responsibility to help students understand the cost of borrowing and the implications of borrowing. And student loan default is a significant outcome that colleges can help prevent, but it also affects people's credit ratings. It can affect whether or not they can get other loans in the future. These have long-term consequences that we should take very seriously.
So then what is a manageable level of debt for that college graduate? How much debt is too much?
That's the magic question. And people have been asking that since 1965 when the federal government initiated the first national student loan program. They're going to ask it in 3,065 or whenever in the future we still have student loans. The question, though, I think sometimes gets decoupled from the other side of the equation, which is earnings. We have, a doctor, for example, might carry significant loads of debt, but they also have high earnings. And so from the public policy perspective, that's probably not a big problem necessarily because they can repay that. And so that's what a lot of folks are trying to get is data that connects both loans and earnings to see the ratio between the two. When we start to do that, it actually reinforces that earlier point that it's the low debt borrowers who are struggling the most.
And technical training has long been billed, calling it the more affordable way, sometimes it's been called, to go compared to a four-year university. Some people have also used two-year schools as a bridge to the four-year. Will we see more students opting not to attend college at all because of sticker shock?
I think that's true. I think there is something. It's hard to measure. It's hard to quantify, but it is real, this idea of debt aversion. And student loans affect students even before they ever borrow because of that exact reason. And so we should be seriously concerned about that. And that's why I get worried about some of the talk that we hear about giant debt loads burdening people and preventing people to be independent in the economy or whatever. Because just the opposite story is also true, that loans can help people invest in themselves. And without that loan, they would never have had a shot at trying to, change career paths or have higher earnings later down the road. And so I think it's a challenge for sure, but I think the biggest cost is not enrolling in the first place in many cases.
Thanks for being with us, Nick.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
That was Nick Hillman, Associate Professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison. He talked to us about how students in Wisconsin technical colleges are facing higher debt.
Coming up, change is the new normal in American life and in global politics, according to our next guest. He'll tell us why we're in the era of mega change. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. Coming up tonight at 7, it's Upbeat Storytelling with Snap Judgment. Tonight's theme, Down with the Ship. There are two kinds of people, those who try to survive and those who dance as the water rises. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
Now, there have been a lot of big changes in the world over the last decade or so, from the Great Recession in the U.S. in 2008 to the rise of ISIS in 2014 to the referendum earlier this year that led to the United Kingdom leaving or on the way to leave the European Union.
Our next guest argues that it's no accident that large-scale change is happening in this modern period. He outlines why these mega changes are happening now and looks at what might be coming in the future.
Daryl West is with us. He's Vice President and Director of Governance Studies for the Brookings Institution. He's the author of the new book, Mega Change, Economic Disruption, Political Upheaval, and Social Strife in the 21st Century. Daryl, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, nice to be with you.
We'll get into some more specific examples, Daryl, but spell out the concept. What do we mean by mega change?
Well, as you pointed out in the introduction, when you look around the world and when you look in American politics, there are large-scale transformations taking place. Part of it is due to economic changes. There are social tensions that are coming to the forefront, and we're also seeing governance failures that are contributing to this. So when you look just at the last few years, we've seen the emergence of Donald Trump, which surprised all the experts, the emergence of ISIS, which was a big shock, the Brexit vote, which you mentioned, and then threats to globalization. And so I argue all these things are connected, and we actually are living in a quite dangerous time due to the large-scale changes taking place.
Yeah, why are all these things happening at once? What's underlying this unpredictability when it comes to these big changes?
I mean, part of it is economic, but part of it is also political. Economically, we are moving from this industrial era to a new digital economy, and there's a lot of dislocations and disruptions that are taking place as a result of that. Change makes people really nervous. If they're not personally affected, they worry about their family members. If they're parents with children, they worry about what economic future those kids will have. But at the same time that there's all this public anger and anxiety about these types of changes, our political system seems very poorly equipped to actually deal with this. We're plagued by hyper-partisanship, by extreme polarization. And so the combination of nervousness produced by these economic changes and the weakness of our political system in addressing the impact of those changes creates a very bad combination.
Well, as you say that, I think about a historical precedent, and maybe this is worrying. I think about the Industrial Revolution era leading up into, you know, the World War I era, where you saw four major empires collapse, the beginning of the end of colonialism, the lead up to the rise of communism, the run up to World War II. Was that maybe a last big era of mega change, and are there lessons we can learn from that?
You're exactly right. I mean, that was early in the 20th century. There were a lot of things going on there. You had the change from an agrarian economy to the industrial era. People were being uprooted. You know, people were leaving the farms and moving to the cities. There were lots of problems in government at that time. Corruption and cronyism were quite common. And so when you see a combination of big economic and political problems coming together, people get very dissatisfied in that type of situation, and sometimes bad things happen. You know, wars happen, violence happens, there's a lot of public unrest. And so I'm not necessarily predicting that will be the outcome in the next few years, but it's something we need to worry about because historically that was what happened in the early 20th century.
Right. Well, we can look at bad news. Syria, obviously, some other places that are currently war zones, Russian expansion, the Crimea. On the other hand, there's a lot of good news. People pointing out, like, for the first time, and I don't know how long, there's no active war in the Western Hemisphere right now. Is it possible to navigate an era of mega change without disaster, without things really going south?
There certainly are good mega changes that are taking place. People are living longer. There are infectious diseases around the world that are getting eradicated. More people globally are being lifted out of poverty. That's certainly true both in India and China. But the problem is that when there's a lot of nervousness among the public, when there are large-scale changes taking place, and our government is not doing a very good job dealing with them, that's the combination that we should worry about. We certainly have the capacity to address these problems. In the early 20th century, we did it. In the aftermath of World War II, when the world was kind of in shambles and major parts of the world, their economies were completely ruined, we did a Marshall Plan, got things back together. We created new governing institutions to help countries around the world that were experiencing problems. So it's certainly within our scope to address these issues, but the question is whether we have the capacity and the will to do so.
Talking to Darrell West, his new book is called Mega Change. Darrell, I want to delve in a little more. You've mentioned globalization some, and it seems like there's so many double-edged swords. International trade can increase economic output, increase prosperity, but it dislocates people. A lot of people lose jobs. The internet was going to bring us together. We were going to meet people around the world. Yay, that happened some, but also it led for new ways for us to argue with each other and to recruit for a terrorist organization. It's unpredictable. There's a lot of unintended consequence that seems to be at the heart of this unpredictability.
Absolutely, and that's a big part of the problem. On globalization, I mean, that has been the dominant regime for the last several decades. And at the beginning, the promise was that everybody would be a winner, that a lot of countries would end up doing much better. But, of course, now several decades later, there are major criticisms of that. People don't think they're doing so well. Workers here have lost jobs. Our manufacturing capacity has gone abroad. But even in some of those countries in Asia, those people feel like they're being ripped off by globalization, that they're not doing so well. And so we're kind of at a turning point now where, you know, if you add the Trump voters and the Sanders voters together, they're probably a majority of the electorate. And a lot of the discontent, even though it's coming both from the left and the right, was due to these economic changes, people's concerns about globalization and fair trade and, you know, is America doing well today? So we're kind of in this transition period where the old regime is starting to fall apart, and we're not quite sure what that new regime is going
to
look like.
What's a leader to do in a situation like that? What is a responsible way to try to provide leadership given that uncertainty?
Well, the uncertainty is being generated by a lot of the underlying economic changes. And so when you look back to the early 20th century when we were experiencing the same types of changes, leaders came along and basically tried to develop policies and programs that would address that anxiety. We had new social programs. We had new types of worker retraining programs that were put in place. So these are the types of things that leaders need to be working on. We need infrastructure investment so that we can kind of build the basis of long-term economic prosperity. So there are very specific and concrete things that we can do. But again, the question is, are we going to do them?
And people have pointed toward a rise in what used to be called strongman politics. You can point toward examples of a strong, charismatic leader rising in, depending on who you want to lump in, Russia, Turkey, the Philippines. Some people have included Donald Trump as a prospective member of that group. Is that likely to be a common response to that uncertainty?
It has been a common response so far, because when you have a lot of changes taking place simultaneously and there's a lot of chaos and disorder and there's unpredictability and people really aren't so sure about how well the future is going to work out, in that type of situation, that is a perfect recipe for these strong people to come along and basically say, what we need is leadership, even if it tends to be authoritarian leadership, in order to restore order out of that kind of chaos. So clearly in the 1930s, that was a common response in many countries to the economic changes of that time. In the current period, you know, we're seeing Putin in Russia, a strong leader emerge in China, Trump here in the United States, some right-wing leaders coming to the forefront in various European countries. So we are seeing certain parallels in this chaotic time period of strong leaders coming to the forefront.
We're talking to Darrell West from the Brookings Institution. He's author of the new book, Mega Change: Economic Disruption, Political Upheaval, and Social Strife in the 21st Century.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What's one mega change that's happened in your lifetime that you didn't see coming? And why do you think there have been so many mega changes in recent years? What patterns do you see in these big changes? Call in now at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation with Darrell West. Maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're picking up our discussion now with Darrell West. He's author of Mega Change: Economic Disruption, Political Upheaval, and Social Strife in the 21st Century.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think, do you feel like the world is changing faster now than it did in previous generations? What is a huge change that happened in your lifetime that you didn't expect? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Darrell, on that question, I'll say, you know, I, like a lot of people, grew up in a world where there was a Cold War. There was a Soviet Union. There was a communist bloc. And as far as any of us, most of us thought that was going to be how it was for the rest of our lives. It isn't. You say in your book you're trying to shake up that kind of what you call presentist thinking. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, a lot of people are trapped in the present in the sense that we think whatever is happening now is going to keep happening in the future. And of course, in this time period, we've just seen so many different examples of things that we thought always were going to be that way that turned out not to be the case. So you mentioned the collapse of communism, the fall of the Berlin Wall. We had the example 10 years ago of the Great Recession. We've seen the rise of ISIS, and then in domestic politics, the surprising rise of Donald Trump. And so all these things are catching people off guard. So I argue in the book that our civic memories often go back 20 or 25 years. It's kind of, you know, we remember what happened during our adult lives. But a lot of the things that are happening now, because the forces that used to constrain change have grown very weak, are really extraordinary. And you almost have to go back 100 years, 200 years or sometimes even 500 years to really be able to put this in context and come up with a parallel for that. So I argue that we really need to study history, that just relying on the post-World War II period is not going to be sufficient, because that was an unusual time period that now seems to be breaking down, and we seem to be rediscovering some of these historic forces of authoritarianism and extremism that long have been part of our human history.
One thing I kept thinking as I was reading your book is, okay, these changes, we've been bad at predicting them. Maybe that's because they're more or less unpredictable. So we don't know what's coming next. It seems like the one thing that could help in any state of change is resilience. Is there some way we can be cultivating that as countries, as societies, as leaders that can help us deal with mega changes?
I think you're exactly right. Resilience is a great quality in this particular time period. And people need to alter their expectations of change, because a lot of people have grown up in an era that featured small-scale incremental changes, and so we tended to think that was the norm and that was going to continue in the future. And now when we see these tidal waves of change, these tsunamis, these large-scale forces that quickly emerge and often have radical changes that take place, we're caught off guard. So part of the resilience is adjusting our expectations to understand that it's no accident that we're seeing these large-scale changes. The things that used to constrain them are quite weak, and so we're likely to continue seeing them.
Let's bring in our callers now. We've got Ben on the line starting us off in Madison. Hi, Ben.
Hi, folks. How are you? So I wanted to make a comment about shifting job changes and job demand. So, for example, we have coal mining. It's a dirty, dangerous job, but a lot of people put food on the table with it. It's also terrible for the environment and less efficient as we find other sources of fuel, preferably not fossil fuel. Those folks who have been coal mining all their lives and grew up in these communities are very upset that the jobs are going away, rightly so. And I'm wondering what governments can do, what society can do to kind of reframe the issue, saying not, you know, screw you guys, your jobs are going away, coal is dirty, but to say, we appreciate you've been working hard supporting the country, but we need to shift things in this direction. And I'm wondering if your guests can talk about perhaps what other countries, maybe the Scandinavian countries, have done to retrain people and shift them into a place where they can still be useful and helpful to society, support their families, but also to get them out of places where there's kind of a net negative.
Got it, Ben. I want to bring Daryl in on that. So when mega changes put coal miners or many other lines of work out of work, Daryl, how can societies deal with that?
Well, Ben is exactly right in how he framed that question. During any period of economic transformation, there are going to be winners and losers, and there are going to be people who are caught up in those transitions, and they're going to lose their jobs. And so as a society, we can't just throw them away. These are often adults who've trained for certain occupations, and in some cases, those jobs simply are going to be gone forever. And as he pointed out, a lot of countries abroad do much more in terms of workforce development and worker retraining to ease those types of transitions, that we need to focus on giving them new skills, helping them to learn computer skills, technological skills, skills that are going to be very much in demand in coming decades. And frankly, the United States does not do a very good job of that. Ironically, we actually spend quite a bit of money on it, but we're not getting good results. So we really need to study those worker retraining programs so that we can get much better results.
Ben, thanks for that call. We're talking to Daryl West. His new book is Mega Change, Economic Disruption, Political Upheaval and Social Strife in the 21st Century. Back to your calls. Jim is with us in Madison. Jim, hi.
Hello there. Say, this is a great conversation. This is the primary conversation that we need to be having in these years. There is so much energy in the system right now. There's so much political energy. There's so much financial imbalance. There's a global the global weather imbalance. What I told your producer was, you take all the things we've been talking about, you add global warming to it, you raise the sea level 1 foot, you displace tens of millions of people. They'll be looking for a place to live. They'll be looking for food. I mean, this is going to erupt in violence, and everybody's going to be caught off guard because this is just how things go. And the things that are holding us back are political. There's enough money in the system for everybody. There's a thing called a guaranteed minimum wage. I'm a truck driver. The technology is going to put me out of a job. But the
Jim, you're covering a lot of ground there. I want to hit that main point you brought up of climate change. Daryl, this could be a big driver of mega change outside of the weather and climate, can't it?
It is going to be a big driver. And in my closing chapter, I actually look at some of the things that are starting to unfold now that have the potential to be incredibly disruptive in the future. And climate change is one of those issues that I talk about. In addition to some countries turning to the right and undermining democracy, robots taking jobs and so on. Like, these are the types of things where we're already starting to see the impact, but that impact is going to accelerate. So in the case of climate change, your caller is right that, you know, there are major cities all around the world that are located either on the ocean, on rivers, or on seas. And if the water just comes up a few feet, which is likely to be the case by 2100, there are going to be downtowns that are underwater. Power plants often are located right on these waterways because they need water to cool things, and so they chose that location. We may have to relocate or build dams around those utility plants. And so when you think about the impact on our economic base, when you think of the impact of climate change on agriculture, oftentimes when countries are under stress and there's a sharp conflict over resources, you do get war and violence that comes out of that because countries need to kind of grab territory in order to feed their people and strengthen their economies. So these are the types of transformations that already are looming. And, you know, we think we're living through a period of great change now. When you think about the next 50 years, there actually could be even more dramatic changes that take place.
Jim, thanks for the call. Time for one more caller, Sarah in Zion, Illinois. Sarah, hi.
Well, hello. And yeah, your producer wanted me to focus on the how technology as a whole has just overtaken our lives, and that doesn't totally surprise me. I mean, it's certainly true, and I don't like it in general, but I'm not against technology. But I have seen this enormous change in the public school system where I work down here in Zion, Illinois, and because I'm an assistant in the classroom, we have a new computer-based curriculum where the kids are hooked into these computers for 75% of their teaching day. And the teachers are now monitors during that time. They don't actually teach. They just let the computer do it. And I was not expecting that at all. Mm. And the classrooms are completely different. And I have seen the effect. We all have seen the effect on the kids. They've only been at this for 2 months, and the kids are behaving differently. And I think it is going to have a really bad effect on kids and people in general as they grow up.
Sarah, thanks for the call. Unintended consequences, Daryl, of technology and the way we learn and communicate.
Technology has the capacity to produce great benefits for humankind, but as the caller noted, it also has the capacity to destroy a lot of things. And the internet is one of the reasons why we're seeing this increase in extremism. You know, it used to be that neo-Nazi who lived in some small town might have difficulty finding a like-minded person who shared his or her point of view. Because of social media and digital communications, it's easy to find people who share your own extreme viewpoint. We also are seeing examples internationally where there always have been local grievances, but they often stayed in that locality. Today, because of global communications and technology, grievances 5,000 miles away become our grievance. We get upset about what is happening in Africa, in Asia, and in Latin America, and it kind of draws us into conflicts elsewhere. So we do have to be careful with technology. It's been very disruptive. It's changed virtually every sector. It has also globalized conflict, and it's encouraged extremism. So we need to figure out ways to get a handle on that.
A lot of food for thought. We'll leave it there for now. Daryl, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Daryl West, Vice President and Director of Governance Studies for the Brookings Institution. We've been talking about his new book, Mega Change, Economic Disruption, Political Upheaval, and Social Strife in the 21st Century.
I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.